Welcome to this session. My name is Ralph Dawes, and this is my wife Cheryl Dawes over here. And we're from Wenatchee, lately anyway. And I teach at Wenatchee Valley College, which I think is the nearest institution of both higher education to Holden Village, just about 8 miles away or so. And a lot of geologists come through Holden Village because, for obvious reasons, I think. So I'm going to take an approach today talking about geology and this week that's partly trying to share with you how I think, or that is how geologists think about these things to see in the earth and these questions about it. So it's partly a history of ideas, especially today, because that gives you a better way of maybe jumping on board and following it through to where you're figuring out the latest questions that apparently haven't been solved yet. I understand, because that's what science is. It's trying to answer questions about the natural world using logic and verifiable, repeatable results and so on. And, you know, I don't want it to come across as too much a received body of knowledge that's already been verified where we don't have to argue about it. So you can ask questions anytime, whether you want to argue or just ask a question. And now I want to mention on Thursday, I think we're changing, just for those of you that will still be around and still want to, considering going to more geology sessions like the one on Thursday. That one, we're going to do for those that are able and willing to walk, we'll walk up 10 Mile Creek Trail a ways, looking at and talking about geology on the way, because I think a lot of you have recently subscribed to the idea that a lot of the best geology learning takes place in the field. So even though it's going to be a larger lecture and discussion here most of the week, on that day, I'd like to go up 10 Mile Creek a ways and look at some great things you can learn a lot about just by studying them in the rocks and in the views. And what else was I going to say? Oh, and Friday is kind of a different topic, climate change. Not so much directly geological, for those that are still around and want to come. Tomorrow morning, the eye-opener, we're going to enact how the Earth dances during earthquakes, sort of. So it's an earthquake, living out what earthquake waves are like as a group. We'll see if that works. That may be an eye-opener. All right, but then today, let's start with today. We have this treasure, switching that from human metaphors to the earth. Obviously Holden is in this wonderful site. It's in the mountains. Now, and one neat thing about geology that I like is it goes into basic questions that seem so basic we might not even ask them sometimes. So an old problem in geology is why are there mountains? What causes the mountains to form? So that's going to be our big topic today. Holden's in a valley here, we're over a big valley in the mountains. Another old question in geology is why are there valleys? What form the valleys? Now we're not going to do that one today so much. That'll come up more later in the week through Thursday, because that comes after the mountains form, the valleys form, kind of, even though it's simultaneous. So what I want to run through is a little bit of history of ideas about how mountains form, and see how that works as the science of geology developed over the centuries out of Europe and then into this country. So an old question in geology is, why mountains? Why does the land go up so high there? And linked with that is the fact that in many mountain ranges of the world, if you look in the rocks, you may find some rocks with fossils of fish or clams or other critters and creatures and organisms from the floor, obviously from the floor of the ocean. So why are there fossils from the ocean floor way up in the mountains? The top of Mount Everest consists of limestone from some old reef or warm, shallow marine ocean environments. So they're on the highest mountain in the world. It used to be on the floor of the ocean. Why is that? Leonardo da Vinci, Renaissance man of Italy in the up to the early 1500s, he considered that question. Why are there fish and clam fossils up in the mountains of Italy? And he took a very scientific approach, trying to reason it out, and he was very much ahead of his time, centuries ahead of his time, but being the way he operated, he wrote it in his secret notebooks that he never shared with anyone at the time. So it wasn't until centuries later that people went over his notebooks and they discovered how far ahead he was, in this case, on the geological question of his time. But I want to mention and here's one way he was ahead of his time, is that the common thinking in Europe back then, say 1500s, was that fossils had never been anything alive. They were fabrications from the rocks that spontaneously formed. In England, they sometimes called them sports of nature. And the reasons ascribed to them were, you know, somewhat supernatural, like partly it may have been astrological. The stars lined up and the planets lined up in certain ways that caused these animal and plant-like shapes to form. Or there were, and the other thing is, this is before reproduction was understood and cells were understood. And this is when a belief in spontaneous generation of life was, you know, was common. So why not spontaneously generate organic shapes, even though they're not living, as part of a process of the minerals in the rocks? That was commonly accepted as well. So for Leonardo to think that the fish fossils and the clam fossils actually came from impressions or mineralized remains of actual fish and clams was out of the mainstream for its time in itself. And that, to me, that's something interesting to think about, because if you go to a museum and you see a fossil of Tyrannosaurus rex, the skeleton is all reconstructed and standing up there, or you see a painting of it, that's all theory. No one's ever seen a dinosaur. All we've got is these minerals or bones that have come out of the rocks, and the other things related to them that come out of the rocks. And from that, we've constructed this idea that there were these creatures known as dinosaurs. And in the modern world, not too many people are going to say, oh, those are spontaneous mineralizations, totally inorganic, that just happened to look like a living skeleton, but it never was. So you see, what we maybe accept as common knowledge now was back then, several centuries ago, not common knowledge at all. And that's one way in which Leonardo was somewhat ahead of his time in thinking that. I mean, you know, you can go back to the ancient Greeks and find reference to fossils where they thought they were things that were once alive. It didn't all come from the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. But that's part of why they call it the Renaissance. Those ideas for naturalistic explanations of things like in the earth were brought back into the fore during the early development of science. And then speaking of the history of science, probably in the English-speaking world, a lot of credit is given to the next guy I'm going to talk about, James Hutton of Scotland, because he's sometimes called the father of geology. That may be overselling it. There was a lot going on in geology during his time. He just had an idea that kind of went out in a lot of ways. So skipping ahead a couple centuries to the 1700s, science was developing more and more. The Linnaean classification system for naming species and genera and so on had been developed, and people were observing and trying to figure out what it meant. I mean, it was really taking off. And during this time, there was a German geologist. I mean, the idea of someone being called a geologist came into being about then. And there was a German professor, I forget which university, who started out in mining but became a professor of geology in Germany. His name was Abraham Werner. You know, the B is a W, W-E-R-N-E-R, and he was very influential, and he had lots of students that were great students, and did a lot of work that was very influential as well. So his idea prevailed for a while about how the rocks of the earth formed, and he ascribed crystalline rocks that we now call granite and basalt, and which even in basalt, if you can magnify enough, you see pretty little crystals in it, like this. Here's a more or less granite rock with black and white minerals in it. His idea was that these crystallized like salt at the bottom of the primeval ocean that covered the early Earth. Okay, so this was called the Neptunist theory or Neptunist school of thought. And then on top of that, sediments accumulated and then but got buried and turned into rock. And on top of that are loose sediments from more recent events. So it all goes to water and sediments and things crystallizing out of water. Now, what James Hutton of Scotland, he lived up to almost the end of the 1700s, not quite 1800. And he was a gentleman farmer who developed some agricultural practice with the property he got from his father and so on. But he became very interested in geology as he worked on improving his soil and looking at his land. And he hung out with a group of people in Edinburgh, Scotland, that included James Watt, who developed the first successful steam engine, Adam Smith, who developed economic theory, the first one who wrote down theory of capitalism, you know, the wealth of nations, and several other people in sort of the Scottish Enlightenment, and Hutton was part of that group. And he argued, in contradiction to Werner's prevailing school of thought, that rocks like granite formed from molten rock, from molten material, that intruded up inside the earth. So, let me draw. next sketch. So Werner had the early Earth covered by some sort of primeval ocean, and then at the bottom of that, these crystal rocks crystallized as salt-like sediments. Whereas what Hutton saw was, here's a closer up view of the Earth's crust, is that molten rock came up from below and intruded its way in, or in some cases erupted to the surface to form volcanoes. So this is molten rock coming from somewhere down below. It's intruding into the, so you're looking sideways at a slice of the Earth, into the crust of the Earth, the top level of the Earth. It goes down quite a ways. So this is the Plutonism, named after Pluto, the Greek god of the underworld. And this is Neptunism, named after Neptune, or in Greek, Poseidon, the god of the oceans. And Hutton, when he was alive, his theory really didn't become the widely accepted one. Cheryl and I were in Edinburgh. We got to be there a couple years ago. And we went on a walk to one of the field sites where he had presented it as evidence for an intrusive origin of granites and rock like that. It's called Salisbury Sill, and it's right there in Edinburgh. It's a great place, so it's a great park, great place for a walk. And we were trying to look at what he saw and see how he saw it, Hutton did. It's interesting because back in the 1700s, they had no photographs, no cameras, so the illustrations were done by hand, you know, like pen and ink engravings and so on. And I realized that you could sort of skew the way things looked kind of to favor your theory, perhaps, in making your drawings to present in publications back then. Because it didn't look quite like I'd seen it in Hutton's papers when we looked at the actual rocks. Maybe the vegetation frown and things have weathered since then as well. But anyway, now Werner turned out to be incorrect. And Hutton turned out to be correct, we think. Even though no one's ever gone down inside the Earth and seen a granite form. But experimentally, you can create conditions using the chemical elements that make up this rock. And the only way you're going to get minerals like this to form is under very hot, near molten or crystallizing out of a molten rock conditions. And you're not going to get, these rocks are not, I mean, the minerals in here are not salts that you're going to get out of a liquid at Earth's surface temperatures. So from chemical reasons, from experimental reasons, and from field observation reasons, which is probably some of Werner's students taught the Neptunian school, went around and started realizing that there are volcanoes erupting lavas that turn into basalt. So that's not salt at the bottom of the ocean. It's still called basalt. But it's, and that may be from the old understanding of it in a way. But it's actually from molten rock, and they eventually got around the Earth far enough to see that happening and realize that their mentor was incorrect in that respect. I think Alexander von Humboldt was one of his students. Some people might know his name, great explorer, scientist, naturalist of the early 1800s. Okay. Well, I want to run through a little bit more about what Hutton came up with.
Well, those Neptunists, they knew about volcanoes, did they not?
Well, what did Werner know? He knew about volcanoes, but down in Italy, the nearest European country that had active volcanoes, the recent eruptions had been mostly pumice and ash and things like that. So they weren't seeing this.
Not lava flow there.
Yeah, but some of his students got down to somewhere in south central France. There was an area where volcanoes have been active relatively recently in geologic time, so you can still see the lava flow shapes and the volcanic cones. And even though they didn't see it erupting, they were thinking, this looks like this basalt makes this liquid flowy shape and went up to that cone of a volcano there. And then eventually some of them saw some active lava flows that were turning into basalt further around the world as the more exploration was done. So I'm not deeply versed in, I don't read German, and what exactly Werner said about volcanic rocks and why he had basalt as not a crystalline rock. But that's the way I understand it. And he definitely had granite as some sort of salt-like rock that crystallized out of it.
I guess I was starting to realize that in the late 1600s that there's not a, and I've just been raised since a child with a consciousness of the geologic features of the whole Earth talked to me from elementary school.
Uh-huh.
And that was not so, even when I educated in the 1600s to to know the geology of China or New Zealand or, you know.
No, I mean, that's part of what Verdu's students were doing. Like Alexander von Humboldt, he was the first person to make, or one of the first people to make big geological excursions to South America, for instance, and look at the volcanoes of the Andes erupting down there. So that came after Verdu for the most part. Even though there are volcanoes in Europe, down in Italy, in the Mediterranean area, it's still a ways from, I mean, I think Werner didn't travel much out of Germany himself, so. And Hutt didn't travel much out of Scotland either, but he had a different way of looking at it. Let's see. So, okay, what another thing Hutton came up with, we now present and teach in geology as the rock cycle. And this gets closer to why there are mountains in a way. But the rock cycle, is, I mean, I can present it as a flow chart, and you've probably seen this somewhere, many of you. So we'll start the rock cycle with magma, molten rock inside the earth. Now, we don't have to explain where the magma comes from at this point. That may not be part of this theory necessarily, except that it's molten rock. Something heated up or caused the rocks to melt inside the earth. And so the magma solidifies, cools, and solidifies and turns into rock. Now, if that molten rock came up out of the earth, under the earth's surface, it's volcanic rock. But if the magma stayed down inside the earth's crust below the surface, it will turn into some sort of granitic rock, which is also, it's a close relative of volcanic rock because they're all igneous rock. You know, igneous of fire from something that was ignited, although in this case molten and red hot. Now, I know from being around students that up to middle school, a lot of students aren't taught about the granitic intrusive side of igneous rock. They're taught about the volcanic part because that's much more exciting and we get to see it happening. Granites, and their affiliates, whether we call them granite or other fancy names like gabbro or diorite, they form down inside the earth where we don't see it correctly, so it's a little bit more of a theoretical understanding. You know, volcanoes, in the end, you can convince yourself this is volcanic rock I saw erupting from the volcano. Granite, we can't, except experimentally, we're trying to duplicate conditions down inside the crust and deep in the earth. We don't see granites forming, so that's a more theoretical understanding. And in fact, just as an aside, I didn't want to touch your memory, so there's a side school of thought, there's still some people alive who subscribe to this, and I've met some of them, called the granitizers, who think that granite, or at least some of what we call granite, forms by metamorphic crystal chemical reactions without molten rock processes inside the earth. And the most recent published geologic map of the Holden area by the U.S. Geological Survey, they recognize these rocks as plutonic igneous for the most part, but they make a few side references to some of it being granitized from that, you know, that other school of thought. Because even through the 20th century, you can, you know, since we don't see these things directly, some people were willing to consider alternative ideas, and we should be willing to consider them for how these granites could form. But I'm going to take that in most cases they're igneous rocks.
You're not a granitizer?
No, I'm not a granitizer. So I'm not. At the University of Washington, for a number of years, one of their leading geologists, especially in terms of having lots of students, was Peter Misch, who originally came from Germany. And being Jewish and German, he left Germany in World War II. Or just prior to, and he ended up in China for a while, in Nationalist China, and then he ended up at the University of Washington in the late 40s. And he was the first one to map much of the North Cascades and consider it geologically. And he was a great geologist, and his maps are valid for their observations. But, you know, in retrospect, it's unfair to him to look at it in retrospect, but he was also a granitizer in a way. So a lot of those interpretations are now not accepted. But his, you know, there's not been a lot of geologists coming through the North Cascades. It's a rugged country. And they have to have certain questions in mind and certain funding to get here. So his footprint is still over the Cascades in some ways, like when some of the geologic maps still refer to granitization as a process for forming some of these rocks. He was certainly through Holden, through River Creek Valley a few times. He's climbed. There's quite a mountain here. And he's climbed probably every peak you can see around here somewhere along the way before he passed away about 15 years ago. Okay, igneous rock, any rock, will undergo at the Earth's surface, it's exposed to air and water, and if it's on a slope, like on the mountains or whatever, it's exposed to the force of gravity and flowing water on the Earth's surface, and ice and snow in many climates, in many places, in many seasons. Anyway, it will undergo weathering. And if geologists are trying to get the original rocks, like the original igneous rocks, they don't want the weathered part. That's why they're walking around with rock hammers, partly to knock up all that weathered stuff. And sometimes the weathered minerals from reaction with the atmosphere and the water and so on make pretty minerals on the surface of the rock. And a LA person might go up to the geologist and say, what is this? What are these pretty minerals? And then if it's a real bedrock geologist, they might say, oh, that's just weathering. Get it out of here. Let's look at the original rock, which is probably not fair to the person who saw the pretty weathering minerals. And erosion, by the way, the weathering creates a lot of the red colors, oxidation of metals, especially iron, on the surfaces of the rocks. Erosion, where the rock breaks into pieces or some of it dissolves, and eventually it gets transported away somewhere and redeposited as sediment. Oh, put that here. So deposition. And that becomes sediment. And in the rock cycle, I mean, it's just an abstract flowchart, but here's where we live. We live in this area, basically. I mean, the surface of the earth tends to be covered by a little bit of soil and loose sediment, if not a lot. We bulldoze and excavate and kick dust around and push boulders off the hillside when we're kids climbing in the mountains when we're not supposed to, and there might be someone down below, but we do it anyway. So we're contributing to the weathering, erosion, and deposition process. As an aside, there's some recent studies that suggest that human land use, especially agriculture, but also other development of the land, is increasing the rate of erosion on a continental and global scale by significantly above the natural background level, amazingly enough. In other words, the sediments flowing off the continents into the oceans have kicked up in the last century because of human land use of the land. But that's an aside. Anyway, this is where we live, from the volcanic and the exposed to the Earth's surface. Other rocks that are undergoing weathering and turning into sediment. But then those sediments will get buried in many cases. And so burial. And as anything gets deeper in the earth, it gets squeezed more and more by the pressure from by the weight of everything up above it. Just like swimming deeper in the ocean, the pressure goes up from all the weight of water pushing on you. Deeper in the earth, the pressure of all the rock and whatever else up above you pushes in on that level you're at and increases the pressure. So burial, that causes compaction. All that pressure, in other words, it squeezes the material tighter together. And typically, if the sediment is like sand grains or gravel or other loose pieces of material, as it gets down inside the earth where it's a little bit warmer and it's under more pressure and it's getting squeezed together or compacted, there's often a little bit of crystallization out of whatever water is in the spaces between the sediment grains, and that will act to cement it together. So that cementation. This is the earth is a water planet, and anywhere in the rock cycle, we could step aside and look at what water's doing there. And that part of the rock cycle is often adding an interesting twist to things that take us partway around the loop in the rock cycle, other than this basic story. But anyway, so cementation is often partly due to things crystallizing out of water in between the mineral grains. Not always, but often. And then you get sedimentary rock. All right, well, with deeper burial and more heat and more pressure, and heat and or pressure, could be just one or the other. They don't always go up together depending on what exactly is happening, where the rock is in the earth. But at any rate, more space here. What happens next is chemical reactions will replace the original rock, like a sedimentary rock, like maybe a dirty sandstone with some clay and other stuff in there with the quartz grains and other mineral grains. Anyway, as heat and pressure goes up, as it gets deeper in the earth, it will undergo chemical reactions that replace the original minerals, at least for the most part, with a new set of minerals without melting. So it's just a chemical reaction metamorphism that recrystallizes the rock. And that turns it into metamorphic rock, changed form. And then with further heat, it might get to where it's melting. And then it's back to magma. Now, you know, not every rock in the earth goes through this loop like clockwork, but these are just pathways. The point is that every geological part of the earth, up here near the surface and in the earth's crust and all the way down, weighs into the mantle, getting a little bit deeper in there. Anyway, every part of the earth, whatever it is, if it's an igneous rock or a sedimentary rock or a metamorphic rock or lava coming out of a volcano or sediment and rocks sitting around on the ground. It's in transition. It's just temporarily at some location in the rock cycle. But given enough time, the theory is, it'll change into something else. And some of it may end up back down inside the Earth melting again, and so on. So the Earth is terra firma. You know, nothing will last us, what's the word I want? Nothing of this physical world down here will last as long as rocks of the Earth and so on. But in geological terms, they're still temporary, or they're going to undergo transitions. Magma, igneous rock, sediment, sedimentary rock, metamorphic rock. By the way, any rock that you can see at the Earth's surface can go into the weathering and erosion cycle. And igneous rock inside the Earth, granite and so on, instead of coming right up and getting weathered off and eroded off to where it's exposed at the Earth's surface, it might take a sidestep and get metamorphosed and reworked in solid state into a new rock instead, a metamorphic rock. So it's not always a loop. There's some cross paths as well. That's Hutton's rock cycle. I mean, it's a little bit modified. It's not exactly the way he didn't draw it that way. He just wrote about it. How geologists think? They have the rock cycle in mind. And if I go to an outcrop, I'm going to categorize what I see there. If I see rocks there, I'm going to go, okay, is it igneous? Is it sedimentary? Is it metamorphic? If it's loose material, sediments, I'm going to try to characterize it as well. If I'm lucky, I might go to a volcano and see some lava. Sure, I've done that once or twice. I'm going to categorize it. As soon as I do that, I've constructed a hypothesis or I've fitted into a theory. If I say that this granite is igneous, it's not just a description. I mean, if I say it's granite, that can be descriptive. It's the nature of the rock, these intergrown minerals, white and dark, that go every which way. That fits the description of a close relative of granite, so I'll just call it granite. That's a descriptive classification, but if I say it's igneous, then I've jumped to a genetic classification, where I'm saying I know how it originated. It originated by magma cooling and crystallizing, in this case, down inside the Earth. So, and there's often a certain amount of tension back and forth in geology between, is that a descriptive characterization of the rock, classification of the rock, or is that a genetic or interpretive classification of the rock? And they work together. Sometimes they work against each other, but usually if our ideas are good, they're going to work together with each other. So I've thought about this, like preparing this lecture, and I often interweave in my thinking about the rocks, the descriptive classifications and the interpretive classifications like igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. Well, those are interpretive. These are Hutton's rock cycle. This is a theory. And the reason Hutton came up with this is because he was trying to explain why there are mountains, why there are continents, why the Earth keeps lifting up and then undergoes erosion and those sorts of things in a way that, now again, see, I should read more of what Werner said. Like, the way Werner explained mountain ranges, I'm not familiar with. And the way Hutton explained mountain ranges was incomplete. Some sort of heat would come into an area of the Earth, melting would go on, some sort of forces would crumple things together, it would uplift into mountains, and it would include a lot of intrusion and maybe volcanism. So the mountain building cycle includes a lot of igneous processes, and down inside the mountains, next to where all the molten rock is, there's a lot of metamorphism. Hutton saw that. But that's about as far as the explanation went. There's still a lot of whys and where does it come from, things that he did not resolve. But his main point was that it keeps happening. These are not the original mountains on Earth. There have been earlier mountain ranges that have formed, eroded away, and gone, and then been covered up by sediments of younger mountain ranges. That was his whole idea. I mean, that's really the gist of much of why he was arguing this, is that the Earth has cycles and they keep going on and on. In fact, as often happens when someone develops a revolutionary new theory, he took it to the extreme. And as far as he was concerned, the Earth may be infinite in age. And one of the last lines in his book, The Theory of the Earth, is that as far as the history of the Earth goes, he sees no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end, an endless cycle. So So, you know, he, just like the guy who discovered the revolutionary theory that the Earth used to have ice ages, Louis Agassiz, or however you pronounce his name, I had to work on that one. He took it a little bit too far, and he started seeing evidence of glaciers in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest where there really wasn't any evidence of glaciers inside. So he was mostly right, except where he pushed it farther than the evidence would actually support him. As for Hutton, he had no way of measuring ages of rocks, except a general sense that things are going on a lot longer than just one, than the Earth as we see it now. This is just the latest stage in a long cycle of these processes. Does anyone know the 20th century theory that does add a lot more explanation to what's causing the magma, where the forces are coming from that are pushing up the mountains and so on?
Plate tectonics.
Plate tectonics, yes.
There's another theory too that.
Yeah, well, you mean for what could crumple the mountains up and cause
the creationists.
Well, yeah, that's an alternative theory, not quite by most scientists. By classification, it wouldn't count as a scientific theory, but it's another. But it's another idea for which they will cite some. A creationist believer would cite some evidence, and so on. So yeah, there's that as well. In which case, the world was created pretty much as it is now, etc.
Well, 10,000 years ago,
with the exception of the one event, the one big event of Noah's flood that at least reworked the surface areas or something.
Are there geologists that are creationists?
There are creationists who call themselves geologists. and I was at University of Washington, I had people go through and get, I mean, I wasn't there that much, I taught field camp, and I was a graduate student who assisted with some of the teaching. But we had a couple students go through the program to their bachelors who were devout creationists. And they would write little notes at the top of their test, I don't believe any of it, but I think these are the answers you're looking for, and they fill out the test. And so we sometimes argued about, should we, you know, put them in a soundproof room and grill them and try to change their mind or something, or should we gently persuade them more and get them to think alternative thoughts, and that's what we try to do, sit around a campfire and a few and talk with them about it, but these two gentlemen in particular, but I don't think we ever changed their mind. They didn't change ours, so. But I think the conversation was the best way to go, so. And the thing that diverges the creationist way of thinking from science, I had to put a finger on it, it's because for science to have worked successfully is it disallows supernatural explanations. It's the Earth, like the Earth or the universe, physically, things that operate in terms of chemistry, physics, etc. That's all it claims to be looking at and looking for explanations in terms of. If there are, whether you want to look for deeper or just metaphysical other than the natural world as you can measure and observe explanations, then, but for most scientists, that leaves the realm of science. So there are naturally going to be conflicts between systems that ascribe much importance to things besides the observable natural world, which I would call supernatural. That's going to run into science, and there's going to be some crossing overs where they don't seem to agree. I would like to think that religious belief could accommodate what geologists come up with for the age of the Earth and the occurrence of biological evolution and so on, without it having to conflict each other, because then I run into conflict with my own mind. But I still have trouble squaring away. So that's just my wish. And I think most Christians in the United States, or a lot of them, are not young Earth creationists, et cetera. So, and if they are, that's of interest.
Listen, it all starts off with how did we get here?
Yeah.
Whether you're a scientist.
I'm only going as far as why are there mountains in terms of forces in the Earth and materials moving around the Earth and ways you can experiment with and observe. But as for why, how the mountains came about is my question. Why there are mountains, why there is the Earth, why there is us, that starts slipping beyond the bounds of what I think I can deal with scientifically, perhaps.
But without anyone wanting to think that I believe this, it's possible to believe that God created the Earth 11,000 years ago pretty much in the condition that it's now in.
Yeah.
With the bones laying in the ground and everything.
Have you heard of this famous book? in the mid to late 1800s, after Darwin published Evolution of Species in 1859. There was a huge debate on this, in England and Europe and in the world. And in the late 1800s, I can't remember the guy's name, but he wrote a book called Omphalos. You ever heard of that?
Say it again.
Omphalos, it's supposedly Greek for navel. In which he just went into great detail about how God created, and according to his identity, it may not have been original, but he wrote a big book about it that was fairly famous. But, you know, light was, it was created with light in transit from the stars, with rocks looking like they could have come from some ancient process in another mountain region and warm soil. But that's just the way it was created. And he was trying to get at why would God have created it that way. I can't remember what he came up with. I've only read excerpts of it. And that you could attack that idea as having some problems, but you know, it's a possibility if you allow for beyond natural explanations for why nature, like the rocks of the earth, are the way they are. Okay, let's see. I haven't learned. Rocks. Plate tectonics. Oh, okay. All right, so I'm giving you a little bit of a history of ideas. You heard about Werner's Neptunism, and that got washed away for the most part, even though it had an influence and was a valid idea for, in the development of it was a useful idea for thinking about, and he trained some great geologists, some of whom turned against that idea. So, I don't want to frown on ideas that turned out to not hold up in the long run as being bad or stupid, because you have to look at it in the context of the history of the time. He was actually a very positive influence on the development of geology, getting it going in the universities and so on. Werner was. Okay, and then but we get past Hutton, but before plate tectonics, you get a couple hundred years of geologists understanding the rock cycle and understanding the rocks, they think. But so how are they going to explain mountains where Hutton left all these things unexplained? Where does the heat come from? What are the forces that causes things to crumble and pile up in the mountain ranges, besides the magma coming up? And that was a difficult one. And it gets back to the fish fossils up high up in the mountains, the rocks from the ocean high up in the mountains. So in the 20th century, this was especially developed in America, based partly on the rocks of the western United States, also the rocks of the Appalachian part of the United States, where there seemed to be an older sequence of similar events. And so starting with what geologists see, they see a bunch of volcanic rocks and ocean floor rocks that get most crumpled up and, to use the geologic terms, folded and faulted, or to use the non-geologic terms, squished and shoved around, into the mountain ranges next to a lot of magma intrusions, and on top there were some volcanoes. And then a little ways out on one side, they find some sediments that would have been on the edge of a continent where it goes off into the ocean, the continental shelf. And they saw that in several mountain ranges around the world, these associations of volcanic and deep ocean sediments, and then continental edge sediments next door, and so on. And so they tried to put that together into an explanation, even though it was mostly descriptive. And this is the geosyncline theory, that on the edge of a continent, there would be a low area, I might need a little more room, where the sediments would start accumulating. Here's a continental shelf, and these sediments are eroding off the continent. Further out in the ocean, an area of deeper ocean sediments, and maybe the sediments got deep enough to start melting, and volcanism and intrusion started happening. And as the sediments accumulated, perhaps their own weight were causing it to sag down more and more. So more and more of this was happening until the whole thing turned over into a big event. I'm doing a bit of a history of science lecture, even though that's not my expertise, so I'm not going to know all the details. A guy named Marshall Kay wrote the biggest book about this way back in 1948 or 49, this geosyncline theory. Somehow this turns into a mountain-building event where the deep ocean sediments get mixed in with the volcanic rocks and the intrusions, and next door, not quite so deformed or intruded, are the continental shelf sediments. And I should have made more space for this. This is the geosyncline, where the rocks sag down and accumulated until it turned over into this mountain building event. Okay? And he didn't have a complete explanation. It was partly descriptive. But so he partly admitted he was speculating that maybe the sediments got so deep that down at the bottom it was hot enough to melt them. And eventually it pulled things into some overturning mountain building event in this geosyncline.
Was that under the ocean floor?
Under the ocean surface for the most part over here. until the mountain building event builds up, and then it somehow works its way up into new land on the edge of the continent. And everything that was spread out in terms of sediment layers gets more scrunched up somehow. It's like there's a fold on the Earth's surface, a big one, where you get sediments coming off the edge of the continent and then deep ocean sediments. And in the deepest part of that fold, it kept folding downward as the sediments accumulated. It eventually melted and somehow scrunched itself up and turned over into a mountain building event. Yeah.
I haven't read Kay's work in its entirety either, but I guess I've simplified it. And the fact that it gets deep enough and you get melting, then the melt is 10% less dense. And it's the molten material that pushes and metamorphoses all of this, and you get a volcano at the edge. I don't know whether that's a misinterpretation of Kay or not.
No, I think he did say a lot about that. And that's partly still, the lower density of the magma is part of the explanation.
Well, it's a great idea because it brings everything back up, and North America fits it, as you said, because out west you have the Sierra Nevada and then mm-hmm. the coast ranges.
And it kind of
everything gets younger. And in Minnesota we have the oldest rocks, mm-hmm. so it all fits.
It does.
That's wrong.
And you could say instead of a false theory, it may have been an incomplete theory. I mean, descriptively it was fairly good.
Yeah.
These associations of rocks suggested something kind of like this actually did happen. But again, it wasn't until plate tectonics that you put what's called a subduction zone. And by the way, tomorrow the topic is plate tectonics, where we can go into this more. But anyway, it's now, all these events happened, yes, but the driving force was plates of the Earth moving around and interacting with each other, and one going down beneath the other, and so on. And now it seems to make much more sense, and it had to be a much more complete theory. But the geosyncline idea was, it was quite prevalent or widely taught through the middle of last century, at least in the United States, by people like Marshall Kay. And it became a little bit notorious because there was an elaborate terminology built up with it, which may have suggested it was too skewed towards the descriptive to really be a very complete explanation, for what was causing things to happen. After the development of plate tectonic theory, which happened in the 1960s, one of Kay's colleagues, younger geologist, rewrote it to try and get it in accordance with plate tectonics, and some of the terms are still used. Some of it's been rewritten and put into plate tectonic theory, even though it's not the whole explanation. But the modern form, oh, by the way, I mean, and like I said, these elaborate terminology elaborate to the novice anyway, who isn't used to the words yet, that developed with it included words like eugeosyncline and myogeosyncline. This was the main center of the mountain building and intrusion in deep ocean rocks and volcanoes. This was the continental crust, not quite so intruded and deformed rocks, sedimentary rocks nearby, in association with this one. And on from there, lots of terms like that. In modern plate tectonic form, where they still use some of these terms, because descriptively it still partly fits with plate tectonics, they take out the word syncline, which is a big downward, it's a downward fold in the earth. They take that word out and they just say geocline or eugeocline or myogeocline. And this kind of refers to one side of the mountain range or the other, or the more the interior where there used to be volcanic rocks and it got more intruded and metamorphosed, and this more on the outskirts where you can still see the sedimentary rocks from some continental shelf, that sort of thing. So some of that terminology is still with us, just like perhaps in the word basalt, some of Werner's ideas are still with us, even though we think his theory was largely incorrect. But even those words are kind of fancy, and you're only going to hear mostly just geologists using those terms, plate tectonicists. Any questions at this point? Okay. Yeah.
Is a mountain building event a dramatic event like Mount St. Helens erupting, or is it something that takes billions of years?
Well, not billions, probably. It's both. It operates on several time scales, but the most common type of mountain range, like we see in the world today, will have a chain of volcanoes like Mount St. Helens. It'll have a volcanic arc, as they call it. So it will include along the way many explosive and also effusive, where it's just lava flowing up, volcanic eruptions. Now, from the viewpoint of the whole timescale of a of a mountain building event, you know, there, the one volcanic eruption is just a little blip along the way. It keeps happening and happening. Eventually, one volcano will stop getting new magma coming up there, and eventually it'll get eroded away, turning into sediments nearby perhaps, and then a volcano starts up over here. So it keeps, but as long as that volcanic mountain zone is active, there'll be some volcanoes occasionally erupting until the driving process stops. The Appalachian Mountains are thought to have undergone several stages of this plate tectonic thing where the one plate with oceanic crust and sediments on it comes in and subducts, in this case, under the other plate that has continental crust on it. And that's the main driver of this type of mountain range, like the Cascades, or like the long ago Appalachians, okay? Now the Appalachians stopped having this, apparently, I mean, they're thought to have stopped having this subduction process happening and the active mountain building with igneous and metamorphic processes going on the scale of a couple hundred million years ago. And they're still finishing eroding away. They're still partly, you know, they're not completely gone. So that's, and they started forming an earlier stage of plate tectonics as much as 400 to 500 million years ago. So I guess in some cases it can approach half a billion years, as long as there's plates coming into that area driving these processes, which we'll talk more about tomorrow with plate tectonics.
The Hawaiian Islands are a very interesting case. We have this hot spot, and it erupts, and then I guess the plate moves on.
Yeah.
And so you get the series of islands.
Yeah, I recommend once you've learned some geology, whatever stage you learn geology, to go to the Hawaiian Islands and study it more. And while you're there, get to the Big Island and go see if you can see any active eruption going on, as long as you don't get too close to any actual lava. That's a different thing. That's apparently not plate. Well, it's only related to plate tectonics in that there's a plate moving across a zone that goes deeper in the earth than the moving plates that are the outer layer of the earth, where heat and ultimately magma are coming up from. So this is the Pacific Plate, part of the outer layer of the earth. My hand is. It's moving across a hot, a source of heat, and maybe some sort of gases that are sort of dissolved down there in the rocks. Anyway, heat and a little bit of elements coming up from down deep, and as it gets near the surface, it causes melting in the upper mantle and crust. I haven't talked about those layers, but the outer parts of the earth. And so volcanoes form above that, and it kind of comes in pulses, so it dies down for a while, and the volcano moves with the plate, and then acts up again, another volcano forms. Moves with the plate, acts up again, another volcano forms, and that's the chain of the Hawaiian Islands, yeah. And so usually when I think about plate tectonics, I'm thinking about plates meeting up along their margins, whether they're going side by side, or coming together, or pulling apart.
Plates moving.
But in this case, it's a hot spot that the plate's moving across. So the plate tectonic connection is it's stringing the volcanoes out into a chain, the Hawaiian archipelago, yeah.
Are there any land forms that have never been under the sea? The reason I ask that, I come from Colorado, which is the high plains, the east part of Colorado, and the elevation where I grew up was 4,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And near where I lived was a little tiny butte that had some volcanic rock on it, and not too far away was a wash where there were oyster beds in the rocks.
Well, I would say there are some landforms that have never been under the ocean, but and that's partly, I think the total answer to that question is currently unknown, because it goes back to the very beginning of the Earth. Was there a primeval ocean before continents formed? When the ocean of the Earth had first formed, was the Earth just thin oceanic crust, or some denser kind of crust, without including continents, so that the initial ocean went over the whole Earth? That's, first of all, that question's not completely answered. There's still an ongoing debate about how early in Earth history the initial continental crust formed, which gets stuck up above sea level. But on the other hand, continents have been around, at least parts of them, for billions of years. And so on them, a volcano can erupt and that landform could have stayed above sea level ever since it formed. Or on them, some volcanoes could have formed and then undergone weathering and erosion and sediments to spread out to the side and got buried and maybe even turning to rock without ever going into the ocean. So some sedimentary rocks are terrestrial, that means from on land as well. At the ultimate level, I don't know, but there are some examples of things that form on continents and never been under the ocean, the geological rocks and landforms. Yeah, well, yeah.
Do they have plates?
That's a great question. Apparently not like the Earth does. Not the whole outer shell of the Earth, which we call the lithosphere, and it's more than just the crust. It goes down a little bit into the mantle. It's these big moving slabs. Like, we're here in North America, we're on the North American plate, it's one of the big plates. There's only, I think, 13 major plates and a few smaller ones. There's a little one off the coast to the west of the Northwest called the One Big Plate. That's not one of the 13 big ones, it's one of the smaller extra few plates. It's kind of an old plate, it's on its last leg, it's the One Big Plate. But leaving that aside for a minute, here on the North American plate, we're on one of the big 13 major plates of the Earth. And we are moving towards Asia, an inch or two every year, which geologically is very fast. If we're going to allow that in geologic time, millions of years can go by, ultimately billions, well, it's not going to be billions of years, it's going to be on the order of 100 million or something. If nothing changes, there'll be another supercontinent formed with the Americas colliding with the Asias and Australias and so on. That's way out in the future. Who knows what else is going to be the case 100 million years from now. And I bring up the idea of a supercontinent, all the continents stuck together into one. Mm-hmm. Pangaea is partly tomorrow's lecture. And it's just about time to end today. So this will be a good segue into plate tectonics, which we'll talk more about tomorrow. And I may give you we'll see. I may have a little hands-on thing you can do tomorrow as far as modern plate tectonics. Before I finish up by answering this last question and taking any other questions that are left, By changing the schedule so we go on this walk on Thursday, I've kind of left out time to go over actual rocks and minerals. But I'm thinking those of you, it's Paul here, who are going up to the museum. How many people are going up to the museum tomorrow? Is it tomorrow? Yeah. And you've already been exposed to looking at rocks and minerals. But how many people want me to fit in more time if you're coming back later this week to more geology for looking at actual rocks and minerals? Maybe, since I've talked a little bit about plate tectonics today, I might squeeze in a little bit of that tomorrow. I mean, ultimately, if any of you do make all the sessions, or several of the sessions, it'd be nice to fit in things that all fit together when we go on the walk up towards 10 Mile Creek. Now, those from Central Lutheran, you've got a whole curriculum going where things are making sense to you already, and you can go up to the mine portal and museum tomorrow. But I'm a little bit freeform right now as we wrap up today's session. There's any consensus majority towards handing out rocks and minerals and going over them at some point in the next couple of days, if anyone wants to. Anyone would be interested in that, maybe? Okay, well then. Yeah.
I'm just going to say that I think it behooves every citizen to know the difference between a rock, a mineral, and an element.
Yes.
And even though they don't want to hear it, I think you should. It's unfortunate to hear.
You want me to end with that?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate to hear that the newscasters and so forth bandy terms around. And a rock has a very definite meaning, as you explained. A mineral is a very definite thing. Mm-hmm. And elements in chemistry, as you mentioned, are different.
This is a rock. This is a rock. It consists of several minerals. Yeah. And those minerals are made of atoms of the chemical elements bonded together in a regular structure inside each mineral. That makes it a crystal. Actually, all minerals are, in a sense, crystals, because in every mineral, very, very specific, important definition here, every mineral is a type of inorganic solid in which the atoms, that is the chemical elements that consist of atoms, are bonded together to each other in a regular pattern. Mm-hmm. It's not random. And it's not a molecule either. Like H2O, the water molecule, that's one oxygen, two hydrogens, that's it. That's H2O, you're done. That's a little molecule. Ice is a mineral. And in ice, there's no limit on the number of H2O molecules that are bonded together with each other into a larger structure with a regular pattern or symmetry to it. And so ice is a mineral. Its formula is H2O, because for every one oxygen, there's two hydrogens in there. But if you were to analyze an ice crystal, the number of hydrogens and oxygens in one little ice crystal, like in a snowflake, would be beyond imagining, beyond our national depth. So,
this is also a thing of beauty and joy forever. There's some views that there are no two ice crystals alike. And a young man, when photography first came out, his dad gave him an Eastman Kodak camera. they started photographing snowflakes on black paper, and there you can get that, I don't know the author, but out of the library, and Bentley, my librarian library. Well, it's amazing, this beauty that comes from the regular.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I mean, you don't always see the crystal form displayed depending on how much room it had to grow, like in a mineral or rock. But when it does, it's quite lovely. And sometimes quite valuable, actually, but also it's also a very common thing. So a mineral has a very specific, you know, technically stringent definition that most people don't know because they haven't taken geology or mineralogy. I mean, think of the 20 questions where you go, is it animal, vegetable, or mineral? That's the different meaning of mineral, but that's what I think most people think of. It's like something solid that wasn't alive, and I guess that's it, that's their mineral. But there's, you know, having that regular structure to how the atoms are bonded together and a specific formula for the ratio of the different types of elements to each other, like H2O or SiO2, that makes them a mineral. Glass, like in these windows, that's not a mineral. It is a solid, but it's an amorphous solid that has no regularity in which way the atoms that make it up are bonded together. They go every which way somewhat randomly, so it's not mineral, it's just an amorphous solid. And then there are molecules, like H2O, and then there are organic molecules, you know, like inside of like much of us. And those aren't minerals for the most part, unless they bond together and form a crystal structure. So it gets kind of complicated. I was talking to some school teachers recently about why ice, the mineral that forms from water, is less dense than liquid water, which is unusual. Most substances, when they melt from solid form to liquid form, the liquid is less dense than the solid, or if they solidify from liquid to solid, the solid is more dense, so it sinks to the bottom. But not water and ice. When ice forms, it's less dense than the liquid, and it floats on top, which is unusual. And it's great for, you know, if you live down in the pond, it works out better that way. But I realized a number of teachers had this image. So I had a picture of how the H2O molecules are bonded together with this. I can't draw it out of my head very well. To make the, if you look at all the way inside an ice crystal, you can see the bonding pattern of how the H2O molecules are arranged into a larger structure, the mineral crystal structure. And the point was that by being stuck together in this bonding pattern, they had to spread out a little more and take up more space than the H2O molecules did when they're in the liquid form all rolling around each other and staying in somewhat closer contact, even though they're freer to move as a liquid. And some teachers said, yeah, well, the reason it has less density is because there's air in between the H2O molecules. And the point is, that was a misconception. And I guess the point is, it's not easy to understand what a mineral is or a molecule and so on, because we don't really see these atoms directly. But in between the H2O molecules is just empty space, which is itself kind of hard to conceive of, I suppose, in some ways. You know, here we have air. But those are important things to know. Most people, in this educator's conference, we found that most people don't know what gas is, that it has weight and consists of molecules and atoms and so on. And that is useful to know. So all newscasters and legislators should go through geology, chemistry, physics.
You might point out that there are a lot of diamonds here in the audience. Simple carbon.
Yeah.
One of the hardest minerals, one of the most beautiful minerals as a crystal, mm-hmm. but there are probably a few people using pencils. That's also carbon and a mineral graphite because of a different arrangement of the carbon atoms. It's one of the softest minerals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the structure is a very important part of it.
Yeah, and diamond, every carbon atom is bonded together really strongly in four directions with other carbon atoms. So every which way, it's got really strong bonds. In graphite, the carbon atoms bond together only in three directions, right? Only sideways to form layers of strongly bonded carbons. In between those layers, there's very weak bonds. So the graphite breaks apart into little sheets or layers.
It
really
makes a good lubricant.
Yeah. So tomorrow, for those of you that are here and want more geology.
What's a rock?
It's gonna be, let me take the time. A rock. I didn't want to talk about rocks because those are slipperier than, they don't have such a strict hard definition as minerals do. I'll talk about rocks are solid. Well, you know, I haven't looked up a good definition. It's not like there's no So I'll make one up here and see what other people say. They are solid pieces of the earth or other objects like the earth, planets and so on. Anyway, solid pieces that consist of minerals or other inorganic solids. Well, is it inorganic necessarily? Can rock be organic?
Like coal was a rock.
And is that organic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is.
And
yeah. I think we can do a better job of defining what a rock is. But the point is, it is a squishier definition. Not all rocks are made of agglomerations of minerals stuck together. Just most of them are, like this one. And some rocks are made of only one mineral, and that's where the distinction between rock and mineral seems to get a little squishy. There's a rock called quartzite that may be made of nothing but quartz crystals. So what's the difference between quartz, the mineral, and quartzite, the rock? Well, one is a bunch of quartz crystals grown and stuck together. And that makes, you know, they could be almost thought of as the same thing. But there are rocks like natural volcanic glass that don't fit the definition of mineral, but it is a natural solid from the earth. And coal, which is made from what was organic carbon, and so it could be considered not to qualify as a mineral if it hasn't formed into graphite or diamond or whatever. It's just organic carbon, but it's stuck together enough to be more or less a rock. Coal is considered a rock. So not quite all rocks consist of minerals, and not all rocks consist of several types of minerals. So there are those exceptional rocks, but most rocks consist of one or more minerals that just ended up stuck together somehow. Yeah.
In Minnesota, we get concerned about radon gas coming into our houses. And now people are finding that if you put granite countertops in your house, mm-hmm. you may have more radon gas.
Are they really made?
Somehow coming out of the granite.
And granite is a rock that will produce more radon than most rocks because it has minerals in it that take in a higher than average concentration of uranium to begin with. Even though it's, you know, parts per billion, you can hold a piece of granite and it's not going to radioactively hurt you, we would think. But if there's a big bunch of granite in an area, it can, that all that little bits can add up, and especially if there's like a crack or a fault or some way of sort of channeling, because uranium is a radioactive element that as it breaks down and undergoes this radioactive decay, one thing it produces is radon gas, which if you breathe too much of it, it can be quite harmful, cause cancer and so on. So
that brings up the fact that if you open your windows in your house once in a while, you don't have anything to
yeah.
worry
about. So
if you're keeping locked up tight,
yeah.
it's not good for a lot of reasons other than radon.
It is, but it's an accumulation and concentration question.
Yeah.
Houses that have excess radon like in their basement, they're probably on some region of granite or a similar rock known as gneiss or some rock like that. It has a higher than background amount of radon production. And on top of that, they may be on top of some crack zone, fault zone, where whatever gas is forming in the rocks is getting concentrated in that one area and then coming up into their basements. And if they could just ventilate their basement, it would be down to safe levels, or ventilate their house. I have heard about granite countertops. I haven't read of any. What I have heard is it's probably not producing those concentrated high amounts like a big part of the earth underneath your house could, especially if your house is ventilated. I don't think. I haven't heard many scientists raising the alarm on that, except that people have recognized the connection between if granite down there is producing radon, why not granite on my countertop? I think it's a matter of that slab on your kitchen counter is too
small. Isn't that coming largely from someone who wants to sell plastic?
Yeah, that could be.
Or if somebody's funding a study, there's a guy at either St. Cloud State or St. John's.
But you got to make your own decision. I mean, carcinogenic things like that are largely a matter of dosage. We're getting exposed to natural radioactivity in the world around us at all times. You put a granite countertop in your kitchen, it might be tiny bit more measurably radon in your kitchen, but if it's ventilated, probably not. It would be very difficult to detect an increased amount. But you have to make that, you know, you can let the EPA set safe levels, or you can make your own decision to not put that granite countertop in. The EPA says it's safe, and I tend towards that way as far as I know about granite countertops. So,
why don't we leave the definition of rock? A rock is a solid that you have to be more interested in.
Wait, so if I lose interest in the mountains, they're going to melt away or what? Yeah, I mean, that raises the idea of what I was talking about, that it's not just rocks, it's also the ideas we construct from them or bring to them that I was talking about today. And, you know, people have gone off different pathways for how to explain those things in the past. We think for a variety of reasons we're closer to an accurate explanation in most cases, but there's always going to be questions and possible changes in the future. So, thanks for coming today.